you are listening to Against the Current, formerly known as On the Point, brought to you by CITR 101.9 FM's News Collective. We aim to bring you an alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and Lower Mainland every Thursday at 3 p.m. I'm Trish Mahant.
I'm Hannah Het.
I'm Ursia Obo.
And I'm Tiffany Ma.
It's Thursday, October 28th. We are still broadcasting remotely, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. It is important for us to acknowledge whose land we are on and who has been taking care of this land for centuries.
It's our first show of the year, and we are bringing you a super-packed episode. Today, we are talking about COP26. Hannah interviewed Catherine Harrison, a UBC political science professor who is attending COP26, to learn why this year's climate conference is so important, and if Canada is on the right track to meet its current emission reduction goals. And we will talk about our show story on Climate Justice UBC's first rally of the year for the hashtag RBC is Killing Me nationwide campaign, where she interviews Harper Johnston, an organizer with CJUBC. There will also be some chat about a Seat at the Table exhibition in Chinatown in Tiffany's interview with Vivian Goslin. And finally, we will tell you more about a very important talk given by Michelle Good and Jessica McDiarmid at UBC's Green College titled Defining Meaningful Allyship as Healing in the Quest for Reconciliation. But first, let's hear from Hannah.
Thank you so much, Trish. So, in just a few days, COP26 will be starting in Glasgow. This is said to be the world's last best chance to avoid the worst of climate change. So what does COP even mean? It stands for Conference of Parties, and these conferences have been happening every year since 1995, with the exception of 2020. The United Nations brings nearly every country together to try to tackle climate change. To understand why COP26 is so important, we need to remember 2015, when COP21 happened, and the landmark Paris Agreement was formed with the goal to keep global warming well below 2 degrees Celsius, aiming for below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Each country agreed to set carbon emission reduction goals and update them every 5 years. Well, it's now 6 years later, but since COP26 was postponed 1 year because of the pandemic, countries are presenting their updated goals at Glasgow this year. UBC is sending 8 delegates to COP26. I spoke with one of them, UBC political science professor Catherine Harrison. We talked about why COP26 is so important for the future of the planet, if Canada is on track to meet its goals, and why looking forward isn't necessarily the best term to describe how one feels before attending a climate conference. Here's my interview.
First of all, thank you so much, Catherine, for meeting today. What are you hoping to see when you go to Glasgow this year?
So I'll be following two issues while I'm there. One of them is Article 6, which is the provisions of the Paris Agreement concerning emissions trading. It's the one outstanding piece of the so-called Paris Agreement rulebook, where the rules that, you know, the rulebook puts meat on the bones of the text of the Paris Agreement. And it's been very contentious to get agreement on how to interpret Article 6 concerning emissions trading over issues like whether countries or individual firms that have carry forward credits from the Kyoto Protocol should be able to use those, sell them under Paris Agreement trading, how to, or even in the case of Brazil, whether to preclude double counting of permits when they're being bought and sold, what share of proceeds from buying and selling credits should go to developing countries. So those are some of the thorny issues that still remain to be resolved there. And the other issue I'm looking at is one that's still emerging, and that's a new focus on fossil fuel production. Historically, the international negotiations have focused on the emissions that occur in each country, and mostly that's from consuming fossil fuels. But there's increasing attention to the fossil fuels that are being taken out of the ground in the first place, because they're often being produced by countries other than those that consume them. So a big report called the Production Gap Report just came out this week, and there is a push for countries to show greater leadership in winding down their production of fossil fuels. So that's the other issue that I'll be looking to attend events and see whether it even comes up in the government-to-government negotiations.
And I know that you attended COP25 in 2019. Do you expect there to be differences at this event in 2021?
Well, in general, this one it's really important for two reasons. The first is that the urgency is even greater. So we haven't made the progress we should have since the Paris Agreement was negotiated in 2015, and time is running out to limit global warming to 1.5°C, which is one of the goals of the Paris Agreement. We've already got 1.2°C of warming, and the carbon budget that is consistent with the amount of carbon we can put into the atmosphere and still stay under 1.5°C is rapidly running out. So this is probably the last chance to achieve sufficient ambition in these international negotiations to limit warming to 1.5°C. And the other reason this meeting is important is the way the Paris Agreement works, it's a nominally bottom-up process where countries come forward with sort of short to medium term targets, and they all kind of link arms and say, well, if you do that, we'll do that. But then the expectation is that every 5 years they are to come forward with a new and more ambitious target. And this is the first COP meeting where countries are expected to increase their ambition and to submit those new targets. It was supposed to be last year, but the meeting was delayed due to the pandemic. And so it's really a critical moment to see what those countries' ambitions will be, especially by 2030, because if their targets aren't ambitious enough, especially by that 2030 target, we won't meet the 1.5°C goal.
And I believe that Canada's targets are 40 to 45% below 2005 levels by 2030.
And net zero by 2050.
Net zero by 2050. Do you think that the way that Canada is going right now, that Canada can achieve this goal?
I think it is, well, there's two ways to think about the way it's going right now. What's been happening with our emissions suggests not. Our emissions have been, fairly stable, bit up, bit down since 2005, but we haven't seen a dramatic reduction. So that 40 to 45% below 2005 means 40 to 45% below now, because we're still at that same level. The good news is that there has been an increase in policy ambition from the federal government, in particular, plans for a much higher carbon price, for new regulatory standards for electricity generation, motor vehicle sales, and especially important, a cap and declining caps for the oil and gas industry. So in theory, those could be enough to meet the 2030 target, but only if we get going really fast, because to achieve that scale of reduction in such a short time, those new standards need to be developed and put into place really quickly.
And then there's other goals at COP26, which include climate finance and protection of natural resources. What do you hope to see from Canada on those other goals being discussed at COP26?
Well, since the Copenhagen meeting in 2009, Canada and other advanced industrialized countries committed to deliver $100 billion per year in climate finance from 2015 to 2020. I'm not sure if we've met that target. I suspect that the world has gotten close, but the next step will be increasing the scale of those transfers. A report by the International Energy Agency, World Energy Outlook 2021, came out just a few days ago, and it anticipated that in order to be on path to 1.5C, the world would need to see $4 trillion of clean energy investment per year by 2030. Now, that's a mix of private and public investment, but 70% of that investment needs to happen in the developing world. That suggests that $100 billion per year is likely not enough. Canada is co-chairing an initiative with, I believe, Germany. And so we have impact beyond our own commitments. The Liberal government has committed to almost double Canada's annual pledge towards that climate fund. I'm not following the nature agenda. There's a lot going on at COP, and so my strategy is kind of pick little bits that I can try to follow while I'm there.
Right. And what are you most looking forward to attending the COP this year?
Looking forward is a really interesting term because COP is a really interesting experience. It's very intense. People are in these kind of windowless conference rooms and big airport hangar-like facilities from early in the morning till late at night. It's not fun. It's not a vacation. It's very, these are a lot of people who are truly frightened about the direction that the world is going, are committed to doing what they can, but doing it as long as they can. But there's a lot of anxiety and fear that we've been failing for 30 years at this point. So every COP, everybody says, this is the one where we have to turn it around. And, the number of chances to do that are really running out.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Celebrating human ingenuity, resilience, and grit. Tell a Story Hive's Game Changers Documentary Edition is here. Calling all local emerging filmmakers in BC and Alberta, StoryHive is offering 30 grants of $20,000 each to capture stories of local game changers that are making their community a better place. Send in your application to storyhive.com/apply by November 10th. If you have a story to share, we want to hear from you.
The haunting debut album Black Moon by Civic TV provides a cinematic backdrop, a modern-day symphony of the dark and light that is our collective reality. Take a listen to Black Moon, now available via Flemish Eye Records and on all streaming platforms.
Welcome back to Against the Current, your source of alternative and undercover news from the Lower Mainland. You just heard Catherine Harrison from Hannah's interview talking about COP26 in Glasgow. Now, let's talk about climate action here in Metro Vancouver. Climate Justice UBC, also known as CJUBC, is a grassroots climate action group that was formed right here on UBC campus. Centered around targeting the fossil fuel industry and climate destruction through finance, CJUBC uses the power of divestment and financial pressure to resist the climate crisis. Currently, CJUBC is part of a nationwide campaign called #RBCIsKillingMe. As public pressure is put on financial institutions to be held accountable for the climate crisis ahead of COP26 taking place, as Hannah mentioned, Indigenous land defenders and settler climate activists are taking to the streets tomorrow to hold RBC accountable for stealing Indigenous land. The Wet'suwet'en Nation has long been at the forefront of the climate crisis, and land defenders are calling for RBC to fulfill its respect to informed consent of Indigenous people in all its financial practices, canceled their support of the Coastal GasLink project on unceded Wet'suwet'en territory and phase out the financing of fossil fuel companies immediately, starting with coal and tar sand related exposed companies. CJUBC has planned a day of action taking place tomorrow from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. at RBC Vancouver's main offices. There will be speeches, chants, award ceremonies, and much more that Harper, an organizer with CJUBC, will touch on in this interview.
Alrighty, so with me, I have Harper Johnson. Hi, Harper. Tell me a bit about yourself and your journey as a climate organizer.
Hi, Arshia. Thank you so much for having me. Hi, everybody. My name is Harper. I am a third-year student at UBC, and I'm studying environment and sustainability with a minor in law. I have lived in Vancouver for a couple of years now, but I'm originally from Hazelton, which is a little town in northern BC, located on Gitxsan territory. I've been interested in climate activism and environmental activism in general since I was pretty young. Growing up in northern BC especially, it's a really, really special place, but also has been constantly put under threat by fossil fuel companies and threats of natural resource extraction. And so I think that's something that has really shaped my interest in environmental activism, is getting to witness organizers in my own community from a pretty young age. Royal Dutch Shell and Enbridge Oil specifically are two examples I can think of from when I was pretty young, trying to put pipelines and natural gas pipelines through Gitxsan territory, and the Gitxsan Nation stood up and asserted their sovereignty, and through grassroots activism, they successfully kept the waters of the Skeena and the Bulkley and the Nass pristine. And Royal Dutch Shell and Enbridge were not able to go through. And so growing up and getting to witness that level of organizing and that level of success as well was really incredible. But also, I think, kind of set up my, my morals from a pretty young age to see that that is what's most important, is looking after communities and looking after the future of your community. And it's a tricky situation, especially coming from a small community, where oftentimes work does rely on industry jobs. However, having to focus on what is best for our future and our environment, it's a tricky situation. But getting to witness that level of organizing from people in my community really was really inspiring. Yeah. And so when I came to UBC, I wanted to continue to be involved in activism. My friends and I had led a couple Fridays for Future rallies at my high school in Hazelton, but I hadn't really done anything beyond that. And I believe it was in second term of my first year that I started getting involved with Climate Justice UBC. One of my close friends invited me to come to a sit-in at David Eby's office in early January, and I hadn't been super involved beforehand. I had heard about the UBC climate strike, and I had attended with my friends, but hadn't really gotten involved further than that. So I was invited to come to this sit-in, and this was in support of the Wet'suwet'en and Indigenous youth that were arrested outside of the Parliament buildings in Victoria. I believe this was in December 2019. And I didn't have a lot of background before that, but I came to this event and was really welcomed with open arms. And we spent the day discussing what it meant to participate in civil disobedience and what it meant to show up for people in our community in that way. And I don't know, I just felt so welcomed and really, really interested, and I wanted to get involved further. So going forwards, I found myself getting a bit more involved with Climate Justice UBC. I started coming to general meetings. I marshaled for the walkout for Wet'suwet'en and helped organize that in early 2020. And they provided a really amazing community and network of people to support learning about activism and climate activism further. So that's a little bit about me.
Could you tell us a bit about the action that CJUBC is helping organize on the 29th?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit of background on why we're holding the action in the first place. So this action is going to be held at 4 p.m. Outside of the RBC on Friday, the 29th, in downtown Vancouver. And so the reason why we are holding it there is because RBC has poured over $200 billion into fossil fuel investments since the Paris Agreement was signed. And this means that it is the biggest financier of fossil fuels in Canada, and actually the fifth largest financier in the world. RBC is specifically currently financing the Coastal GasLink pipeline. The Coastal GasLink pipeline is located on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. And through financing this pipeline, RBC is actually putting the lives of Indigenous people, especially the Wet'suwet'en Nation and Black and Indigenous people across Canada, in danger by funding this colonial violence and the police brutality occurring at Unist'ot'en and Wet'suwet'en territory in general. So coming up pretty soon here, on November 1st, the UN Climate Change Conference will commence in Glasgow, Scotland, with a focus on climate finance. And this will be providing us with the opportunity to really put pressure on RBC in anticipation of this event, or to hope that they will be listening to the demands of our future generation. So this kind of leads us right to the event happening on the 29th. On the 29th, we will be calling on RBC to stand in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en land defenders and to respect and uphold free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous peoples, as has been outlined by the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which was fully accepted by the province of British Columbia last year, and now is being so obviously and violently disregarded. I mean, which is unsurprising, but still, we are hoping that by having this event, we can put pressure on RBC to stop financing fossil fuels and hopefully eventually defund the Coastal GasLink pipeline and save our futures. This event will be public, COVID safe, and will feature rallies, an awards ceremony, lots of chants, and a screening around the theme #RBCIsKillingMe. It will take place at RBC Vancouver's head offices from 3:30 till 6 p.m. at 1025 West Georgia Street. I realize I said 4 p.m. earlier. Hopefully listeners are still listening right now. It is actually 3:30 p.m. And this is part of a National Day of Action in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en Nation, who are targeting Canada's biggest bank for debt financing investing in fossil fuel projects such as Coastal GasLink. For a bit of context as to what Coastal GasLink is, this is a fracked gas pipeline that will be cutting directly across Wet'suwet'en traditional territories. During the summer, I was a RAF guide with Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition, and we were invited by the Cassia Matriarchs to come to this section of Wet'suwet'en territory and raft with land defenders and Cassia Matriarchs right from the headwaters of the Wet'suwet'en River, which is the river that's at risk here, right down to Unist'ot'en. And in the process, we went right by the pipeline right of way. And so this pipeline would cut directly underneath of Wet'suwet'en. And Wet'suwet'en is one of the largest salmon-bearing rivers in the province. It is incredibly important. It sustains the Wet'suwet'en Nation and all the nations and communities that flow downstream of it. It is some of the purest and freshest water that is left in the world. And this is what's at risk. And especially getting to see that space, that section of Wet'suwet'en territory is so beautiful. And it is in extreme danger right now. So this is incredibly important. As we mentioned before, RBC is financing financing the destruction of these lands and financing and financing the destruction of clean water for Indigenous peoples, and it's pretty horrific. So this action is super important, and it's happening in at the same time as actions taking place at the Gidimden checkpoint, which is located on Wet'suwet'en territory in northern BC, as well as actions taking place in Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Halifax, Ottawa, Kingston, Winnipeg, and Waterloo. And here, basically across Canada, protesters of various stripes will be delivering their message to RBC branches.
I mean, that's crazy. That is a lot of work that you guys have put into this whole National Day of Action. And so I'm wondering, what are some goals that you hope to accomplish with this action?
Yeah, so some of the goals that we hope to accomplish with this action include spreading awareness about the role that banks such as RBC play in hurting the environment and Indigenous people's lands. We also really want to spread awareness about large-scale greenwashing. As greenwashing kind of refers to the idea that RBC is publicly committing to having a quote-unquote inclusive approach that is supposed to be built on long-standing relationships with Indigenous communities and relationships that are supposed to be built on mutual respect and shared values. And this is what RBC is trying to say that they are publicly committing to and support, yet they continue to fund CGL. So this is greenwashing. They are completely trying to show that they are in support of youth and the climate crisis and in support of the Wet'suwet'en Nation and land defenders and Indigenous peoples in general. And this is quite frankly, like, incorrect. And it's untrue. And so if built using RBC's funds, the Coastal GasLink pipeline would expedite the construction of bitumen and fracked gas pipelines and would create an incentive for gas companies to tap into shale deposits along the pipeline right of way, which runs from interior BC all the way to Kitimat on the northwest coast of British Columbia. This project kind of envisions an energy corridor through some of the only untouched areas left in this entire region. As I mentioned before, this would cut right through Wet'suwet'en, which is an incredible, incredible river that sustains so many people. And it would cut right through right through to the coast and would damage such a massive amount of Wet'suwet'en territory. And some of the only untouched areas left in this entire region. And as we know, there are so many water crises and going on in Canada right now, and it's only being furthered by developments like this. So if Coastal GasLink were to be built and become operational, it would irreversibly transform the ecology and character of northern BC. As part of my own personal opinion on this as well, when we damage these rivers and poison these rivers so that the water is no longer drinkable, is no longer usable, can no longer sustain salmon, which sustain all of the communities in the north. Salmon are a foundation for not only sustenance, they're not only a food source, but they're also a huge part of the culture in northern BC. And so destroying the main food sources and the main water sources in northern BC, this is a direct attack on the people that live there, and a direct attack on Indigenous nations. And especially with BC and RBC all saying that they don't want to support ongoing colonization and, quite frankly, genocide, these actions do not align with that statement at all. By funding Coastal GasLink and by funding natural resource extraction in general, they are supporting colonization and they are supporting the ongoing genocide of Indigenous peoples in Canada.
I mean, this work is so, so important, and I'm glad that you guys have these clear goals to address, so RBC knows exactly what the problem is. I mean, they do know what the problem is, they're just not accepting it. But after this action ends, does CJUBC have any future plans in the work?
Yeah, absolutely. So this action looks pretty similar to what a lot of our future actions will also look like, as a lot of our work in the past has been centered around targeting the fossil fuel industry and climate destruction through finance. We realize that the power of divestment and financial pressure is super powerful to resist the climate crisis, and it can be really effective. It can be really effective to organize financial pressure from the grassroots. So we've been doing that internally with UBC's divestment and externally with this action at RBC and other work on bank divestments. So the next steps for us, we are planning on holding UBC accountable to following through on its full divestment commitments that it made in 2019. For those of you who remember the UBC climate strike, a big part of that was to pressure UBC to divest, and UBC committed to that. And so we are planning on holding them accountable to following through on that promise. We are also, so a big part of that is launching a community reinvestment campaign. We want to get at least 5% of UBC's endowment back into regenerative, fossil fuel free community initiatives to create the future green economy that we really want to see here. Things like cooperative housing, for example. We understand that the power of UBC's endowment to kickstart a better economic way of being. And yeah, we want to help that happen. And a bit more of a smaller scale, we're looking to do a lot of skill building this winter, teaching movement skills. These workshops and skill building activities will be open to everybody who is interested during the winter exam session. For those who want to learn more about grassroots organizing or just to further their own skills in organizing, or learn about nonviolent direct action training, there will be so many opportunities. And we really encourage anyone and everyone who is interested to come and learn and grow with us. Yeah. And beyond that, we are always looking to mobilize to support land defense against TMX and other fossil fuel and natural resource extraction endeavors. And so we are going to be continually mobilizing in solidarity with other Vancouver and broadly Canadian movements.
Wow, thank you for that. And that all sounds really great. Thank you so much, Harper. I really appreciate the time you took to do this. And good luck for the RBC action on the 29th.
If you attended a federal Indian Day school, now is your time to make your claim. If you experience harm at your school, you may be eligible to receive a check for compensation. Remember, you need to make your claim before July 13th, 2022. See if your school is on the list and get free legal help. Start at IndianDayschools.com or call 1-844-539-3815. Claim what's yours.
At Dunkin' Donuts, each and every
radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite.
Indeed.
Dunkin' Donuts, serving sweet treats from the Pop Underground. Thursdays, noon to 1.
Welcome back to Against the Current, your source of alternative and uncovered stories from the Lower Mainland. You just heard Harper Johnson talking about the RBC is Killing Me Day of Action. Our next story is about the exhibition A Seat at the Table. A Seat at the Table is an exhibition currently on view at the Museum of Vancouver and the Chinese Canadian Museum. This exhibition uses food culture as an entry point to explore the diverse historical and contemporary stories of Chinese Canadian immigrants in British Columbia, Canada. A Seat at the Table is a collaboration between the Museum of Vancouver, the City of Vancouver Chinatown Transformation Team, researchers from UBC, and many other historians and designers. This week, I sat down with Vivian Gosselin, the Director of Collections and Exhibition at the Museum of Vancouver and the co-creator for A Seat at the Table.
Vivian Gosselin, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so we can start with an open question. You know, Seat at the Table exhibition, the theme is all about like food and culture, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess for the opening question, I would ask you, what's your favorite Chinese food, if you have a great one?
This is the hardest question ever. Because there's so much amazing food and it's such diverse cuisine because of the diasporic community, right? So, but one of my favorites over the years has been the barbecue duck and eggplants, anything with eggplants, stuff with like shrimp, paste, mm-hmm. anything with black bean sauce. Yeah, can't go wrong. And yeah, so, but it's very difficult because you have Malay Chinese, you have Hakka cuisine, you have, so I've been impressed by all of these cuisine, and yeah, it's been a real treat.
Mm-hmm. Barbecue duck, right? Barbecue duck or barbecue pork?
Barbecue duck. Oh, well, barbecue pork too. Anything barbecue chicken. Like, there's so much good food. And, you know, the nice thing is it was part of my homework, you know, field trips. I had to study, right? Like, as we were working on this project. So it was, it's been, yeah, a real experience for the palate at the same time as sometimes mind-bending kind of discoveries for you know, things that I should have known that I didn't know about Chinese Canadian. So yeah, all over, like all around, a very rich experience and multisensorial experience.
Can you walk through the different zones of the exhibition in Museum of Vancouver? I know that there are like this, like waiting to be seated and then taking a seat, you know, there are four.
Yeah. So always on, like, and so you understand by the, like, the names, the titles, that we wanted to keep this analogy, the food and restaurant culture analogy throughout. So the design, as much as the language, it was very important. And some of the key messages, like I said, this is not a Vancouver-centric, but it's a provincial story. It was really important to highlight the great diversity of immigrant experiences. So, you know, people have families that arrived 150 years ago. Some people just arrived. People come from different parts of the world. And so that was very important to have that represented throughout the space, right? In terms of zoning, and so this is, again, like the, so each medium has its own way of conveying or of storytelling, and exhibition space is very grounded in space. So what you have to do is, okay, in that zone, we're going to be focusing on this, and the other zone, we're going to be focusing on that. So one of the story, one of the first area was hungry for change. Then we're talking about why people decide to move, like change place, migrate to British Columbia across time. So the idea was not to create a chronology, but really talking about different experiences of arriving in British Columbia. So again, not just Vancouver, but, you know, all over. And in that area, it's this sort of typical Chinese diner, not a literal kind of representation, but people really got the idea, right? Like the booth, the stools, the fish tank, you know, the aquarium, all these kinds of elements that's like, oh yeah, I know where they're going with this. So it makes it cozy, a little cheeky, and people get to sit and see these, you know, videos of people talking about interacting with indigenous communities, different period, coming and not speaking the language, or also connecting with their home village, right? So all these different kinds of experience of arriving, interacting, and connecting with your home village, wherever that is. The second zone is called Wait to Be Seated, and it's about like white supremacy, racism in British Columbia. And the advisory committee, you know, said, like, you can't be subtle about this, right? Like, in all the stories that we tell, there's references to racism and how people navigated, you know, their lives and dealing with, you know, the Exclusion Act, or not being able to swim in, you know, a specific swimming pool, or being kind of limited in their occupation. So, but there was a need to have it kind of like in your face. And so that really is the Wait to Be Seated section, where you have these giant lanterns. From the onset, like people, and it's interesting when you attract visitors, they think it's beautiful. And then, because they look at these beautiful floating lanterns, and then you get closer and you look at all that text, and it's all that really racist kind of text that's all the bylaws from different, you know, like provincial, federal, city, at the city level. They are texts that are black and white, outlining the like discriminatory measures against Chinese. You also have like historic, mostly historic texts, but also quotes that we took, that we gathered from people living today and experienced racism. So we wanted to make sure that was not a thing of the past, but that racism, as we know, was as well and alive today, not as blatant, not as explicit and in your face, but it is there. And so that whole area deals with that. And then last section, and I'm really, outlining, like large wide brushstrokes, is a section that is also about sitting down, and it's more like the round table, more reminiscent, if you want, of the Dim Sun restaurant, where people can sit. And again, there's content there, and that is more kind of a reminder of the importance of home cooking. And when talking to artist Paul Wong, he said, you're talking about restaurant, but really restaurant food really started at home, like home cooking, the comfort food. And so we worked with him and had some of his work displayed. He did a lot of research around interviewing his mother and having her touring, literally touring her cupboard and explaining all the different jars she had. She was collecting different food, the traditional Chinese ingredients, and explaining to him what it was used for. And so you see the video or the film, as well as those, that beautiful installation of jars that look like really ordinary jars, like Miracle Whip, and then you have like dried mushrooms in it. But as a whole, it just looks at that beautiful display of domesticity, like of domestic objects of the everyday, but made beautiful, because that's what happens when you work with artists, is they're able to make you see the very beautiful and simple or everyday things. So that is the last section.
Next question would be, so right now the exhibition is already open for a year already. So it's open till January 2022. So I guess what's the exhibition team doing right now? And, going forward in the last 3 months, is there any plan? And, what's the plan after the exhibition is being taken down?
So the exhibition, both exhibitions were built and designed so that they could travel. So right now we're working with the Chinese Canadian Museum and kind of figuring out the touring potentials of the exhibition. So there are several sites, museums interested in hosting the exhibition. So that in itself requires quite a bit of coordination. We have like objects that are on loan from private and public collections. So we have to kind of manage those relationships. But at any given time, the Museum of Vancouver will work on 4 or 5 different exhibition projects. So one that, one of the things that we're trying to do is we create connection with the with communities. You want to continue working with these people, maybe not on the very same project, but on similar projects. So the next one that I'm working, the exhibition opening in a year from now, is the Tobias Wong project. And Tobias Wong is a visual artist, a designer, Tobias Wong is a visual artist, was born in 74, died tragically in 2010. He was a real rising star, more known outside of Canada than in Canada. We had an exhibition in 2012, 2 years after his passing. We're doing one now, working with more partners in looking at how artists of BIPOC artists have been underrepresented in museums and art galleries in art history. And so we're taking his case, if you want, to and working on inscribing him in Canadian art history, really creating an argument for this artist is amazing. Here's what he's done within 10 years. He's got to be in our art history books as of now, right? And working with, you know, Simon MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, the M Plus Museum in Hong Kong, and all these museums are like dying to get this collection, right? So from the Wang Estate. It just happens that the estate is in Vancouver. So we're brokering these relationships, working with Chinese Canadian here, but working with people from the diaspora in the States, and really kind of creating a critical mass of analysis on his work. And so it's really cool because I continue working with Chinese Canadians on a totally different project, not the same individuals, but with the same kind of social justice pursuit at the same time as, there's something very fresh and new. Like, this is not a seated table, but there's elements of that we find in Tobias Wong's kind of the case of Tobias Wong. Like, why was he not more present? Why didn't we ever receive Canada Council for the Arts money? All of those questions, and working with emergent BIPOC curators on kind of writing a new narrative that will raise his profile.
Yeah, another thing that the team is working on is definitely the catalog. I guess we finished working it.
Okay. Yes, the catalog.
We can talk about the catalog.
Yes.
So last week on October 20th, mm-hmm. Sit at the Table team, they had an online kind of talk / conference.
Book launch, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Book launch on the Sit at the Table catalog.
Correct.
So it's the catalog, it's over 170 pages. Kind of booklet that documents all the images, stories that both exhibitions have. So you can talk a bit about, the process and,
Of course. So again, the openings of the exhibition were staged, were phased, mm-hmm. and same thing with the catalog. So it opened almost a year after the opening of the exhibition, just because let's blame it on COVID. But again, it gave us time to do something really interesting. So we were looking at, okay, we have all the images, we have all the stories. It shouldn't take that long, right? Just to put this on paper, but it doesn't work that way, because every time you change, like from a book to a movie, or from a movie to a book, or in this case, from an exhibition to a catalog, it requires some adaptation. And so it took me much longer than I thought it would, because when you go in an exhibition, you'll see all these different levels of text, like the big fat text, easy to read, and then you have like secondary text that are a little smaller, then you have like captions, and in this case of the Museum of Vancouver, we had these menu size texts, so they were like, at one point you don't want to have text all over the walls, right? So we had text in menus, so we could cram more content because these stories were so amazing. But when you get to put them in the catalog format, it had all that kind of there was no more hierarchy. So it made it very difficult to get a grasp of this book. So we had to come up with some kind of methodology, if you want. So we find that, people who will have been to the tree exhibition will definitely recognize, oh yeah, that section is definitely about a seated table at the Museum of Vancouver. The other portion is very much the one that we saw, the Hansing. But we wanted, for example, all of the artworks that are on both locations, we put them in one section. Same thing with all the artifacts. Instead of having them divided up into exhibitions, we put it in one section. We also added some curatorial essays, some reflective pieces from Henry Yu, Denise Fong, and myself. That was the three co-curators. And we also wanted to keep that multilingual kind of quality of the project, because what's very important, and this is thanks to the work of Su Chen, the translator, is everything is in English, but if we want to be inclusive, like it made a lot of sense to have the same text in traditional Chinese and in simplified Chinese. in a catalog, though, like it becomes really, really thick and hard to read when you have three languages. So we divided it into two. So one is English and traditional Chinese. The other one is English and simplified Chinese. And so that in it, like in terms of format, there's also a really cool like QR code. So we wanted to have like people get a sense of like that multi-platform kind of the quality of the project. So you scan the QR code and you get to access those digital maps that you see at the Museum of Vancouver or some of the videos that you see at the Hang Seng.
So yeah, I guess the very last question before we end, if people are interested, where can they get the catalog and how can they pick that up?
So they can buy it on Shopify. So if they go on the website, they can, they'll see a link and then they can buy it online. So have it shipped, or they can come in person at the Hang Seng building in Chinatown or the Museum of Vancouver. And it's $45 and you get a very unique set of stories. I think there's something very important that happened in the making of this exhibition. So in the making that catalog that makes it unique, I think something happened in the historiography of British Columbia. And so if you want to own a piece of that history, you can now.
Thank you, Vivian, for coming on the show this week. Again, A Seat at the Table exhibition is currently on view at the Museum of Vancouver and the Chinese Canadian Museum. Hey Trish, you went to the talk by Michelle Goodwin and Jessica McDermott about meaningful allyship and reconciliation last Thursday, right? Why don't you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so I attended the super important talk about allyship and reconciliation at UBC's Green College. The talk was hosted by Michelle Good and Jessica McDermott. Michelle Good is a Cree writer, poet, and a lawyer. And Jessica McDermott is a Canadian journalist who has worked all across North America and Africa and has published a book called Highway of Tears, which tells an absolutely heartbreaking story of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls along the Highway 16 between Prince George and Prince Rupert. The talk was titled Defining Meaningful Allyship in the Quest for Reconciliation and covered so many important topics, and it started out with discussing how media is complicit with the colonial agenda, especially in the context of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. One really interesting thing was that in the conversation, they mentioned that the book, Seeing Red, is about how media perpetuates stereotypes, but Michelle Good mentioned in the talk that the book refers to the media as curriculum in the sense that by embracing the colonial agenda instead of reporting, they're in fact presenting and educating the Canadian population, but with a false history and a false perception regarding what's really happening with Indigenous people. And apart from Michelle Good and Jessica McDermott shedding light on the compliance of the media and the colonial agenda, at the talk, Michelle Good answered the very critical question, what does it mean to be an ally today? And what does reconciliation mean in the 21st century? And here's a short but very powerful clip from the talk where Michelle discusses this very question.
What is the role of a non-Indigenous ally? What is meaningful allyship, if you will, in the 21st century? And my feeling about this is that it has become quite fashionable to raise your voice, send a tweet, do a post on Facebook, you know, wear an orange shirt. But when you think about how intensely Indigenous people embraced their roles as allies, it was during the First and Second World Wars, the number of Indigenous people that signed up was phenomenal in terms of the percentage they represented of their overall population compared to the percentage of non-Indigenous people and their population and them signing up. They signed up in droves. And so you have to think about the era of the First World War, 1918-ish, and the era of the Second World War, you know, up to 1945-ish. And you have to think about what was being done to Indigenous people by non-Indigenous Canada. What was happening was some of the most intense violence against Indigenous people in terms of removing by law and policy the hallmarks, if you will, of nationhood. When those allied relationships were existing back then, when these North America and, well, when the US and Canada were becoming the US and Canada, it was the relationship between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people was a nation-to-nation relationship. It was a relationship of equals. Through the activities, through the objectives of colonialism, which is basically to get us off the land and, you know, so that the resources could be exploited fully for settlers. Even then, even in spite of the intense abandonment by our allies, that is the non-Indigenous people, Indigenous people stood up, went to war, and died for the loyalty of their commitment as allies. Now, that's what we need to see. That is the intensity of allyship that is going to effect meaningful change. And that's the thing about reconciliation. And, you know, reconciliation is more, so much more than apologies and, you know, short-term funding project. It is much, much more than that. And it simply cannot occur. It cannot take effect until we first have truth. And there has been a phenomenal resistance to truth in this country. And only recently, when there can be no denial, okay, there can be no, the evidence is so intense that it can't be denied. And of course, I'm referring to the discovery of the unmarked graves right across the country. And, you know, I can tell you with certainty that we've just, it's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of remains that have been located. 2015 and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the calls to action under the heading of missing children and burial sites, there were six calls to action that essentially provided a roadmap for the federal government to begin addressing this very, very disturbing reality of the children that just never made it home. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission asked for the outrageous sum of $1.5 million, that is tongue in cheek, to begin this process of helping Indigenous communities to do the work to find these children and to bring them home. And Mr. Harper was the Prime Minister at the time, and he simply said no. But it doesn't just rest on his shoulders. Mr. Trudeau said no too. And it wasn't until Indigenous people themselves, by hook or by crook, found the necessary resources to find the remains of the children. And they found over 200, okay, in one effort. And so it wasn't until Indigenous people produced the bones, produced the skeletons, that finally, you know, the rest of Canada is having this moment of, oh my God, you know, oh my God, these schools were a life and death experience for these children after all. And when we juxtapose that, when we juxtapose the, you know, the, I guess, degree of devastation that has been wrought on Indigenous people in this country, and we compare that with their ongoing commitment of loyalty as meaningful allies, we have to ask, why doesn't it go the other way? Why is it that non-Indigenous Canada has not felt that deep loyalty, that tremendous responsibility to stand in a meaningful way, not just words, not just apologies, not just the orange shirt, but to absolutely insist on justice for your allies, for the descendants of the indigenous people that fought alongside the French or the English to create the nation that we all proudly call Canada our home. That's the question.
And that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Against the Current by CITR News. We are here every Thursday at 3 p.m. bringing you local news. Stay tuned for more amazing programming.
Hey, this